Here.
Erev Tov, good evening. Just wanted to welcome everybody and commend you for showing up with integrity and with sincerity. I've been able to listen to these shiurim as I was away in the camp over the last few weeks. And I've been just overwhelmed with pride that our community is able to have this kind of engaging exchange on a topic of great sensitivity and complexity. As observant Jews, we face issues that can sometimes seem overwhelming with special tools. And we use the Torah as our compass and halacha as our roadmap. And I wanted to personally appreciate Rabbi Clapper, who has been our tour guide. And personally, I consulted with Rabbi Clapper, of course, over the years since he was my Rebbe in 11th grade at Maimonides. And it's just such a zechut to have you in the community to help me and to help us navigate these issues with integrity and with sensitivity. So thank you so much, and we're looking forward to the final in the series this evening.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Shesses. It is wonderful to be in a community with Rabbi Elikhi Shesses, and so wonderful that all of you come and come to learn. Really, really a joy and a privilege. I want to make just a note about format tonight. I didn't write it out because I thought that would make it seem too rigid, and it would imply that I actually had conclusions as opposed to trying to direct a conversation. At the same time, I am mindful of Chazal's description of the dangers of the shiurim Antignish Beni Antignish Ish Socho gave when his students Sadok and Baitos walked out in the middle and thought that they had gotten the whole shiur. And I know that some people will probably have to leave at a certain, at 9:30 or something, whatever your bedtime is. So I'm going to take fewer questions during the shiur than I usually do, because I want to make sure everybody stays till the end. So at the very beginning, like some of the Makorot, I'll take comments from people who are here in Chavruta, because I think you earned that. But I'm probably going to take fewer comments in the course of the shiur, assuming that I end the formal presentation somewhere between 9:20 and 9:30. I'll take questions, public questions, for as long as people want. At some point, people obviously are welcome to leave when they wish. And at some point in previous weeks, we've just broken really after the shiur and let people come over and ask questions privately. I think that possibly today it's important that people hear the questions other people have. So I will, at least for a while, take public questions. And if people need to leave, they need to leave. But just be aware that's probably how we'll structure it, that I'll take questions at the end and I'll take them publicly, because I think people should hear each other's questions if they want. Okay, I'm going to start by reading something on page 5 of the Makarot. This is from a book, Values in Halacha, 6 Case Studies. That was published this year. I happened to obtain it because I was at a dinner in honor of Rabbi Samuels, and they gave the book as a freebie. It was certainly worth the price of dinner, which was excellent anyway. And I'm glad to honor Rabbi Samuels. So all right, win-win all the way around. But I have been, I think, wrestling with this book ever since I got it, and I'm going to continue a very public wrestling with it now. So here's what it says. The paragraph before talks about how obedience to halacha is a joy to the observant Jew. Sometimes it's hard, but it's always a joy because you get to know you're doing something meaningful, you get to do what God wants. And so the experience of halacha is one of joy. To the posek, however, he says, fidelity to halacha may be not only difficult, but agonizing. Inevitably, he is periodically confronted by situations in which halacha comes into apparent conflict with human needs, not simply with shallow utilitarian desires, but with genuinely worthwhile human needs. Under these circumstances, the process of decision can be soul-searing. The sacrifices, and they can be enormous, which he may be ready and willing to make himself, he is morally and psychologically reluctant to exact from others. The process of decision becomes, therefore, quite apart from the specific issue being decided, a moment of truth, an ethical and religious problem in its own right. It is the ethical and religious desire to be sensitive to both the halachic and the human dimensions of a situation, or rather, to be sensitive to their interaction, which produces a profoundly agonizing dilemma. So, this is beautiful insofar as it goes. And it was, you know, very powerful to me as a description of the posek, but there are also ways in which I think it fails. Right, one way is that, you know, I think that the description, you know, which only the posek faces these kinds of dilemmas, as opposed to everybody who observes halakha, at times will face conflicts between the halakha and other people's human needs. So I think that the description between the absolute gap between the ordinary layperson's experience and the posek is far too stark. I think Ruim Dvarim Lemisha Amram. I think Lichtenstein, when he had a shaila, asked it and he followed the posek, and it was really straightforward that way. Once the posek paskin, but I think that for most of us, that's not really the nature of the religious experience per se. That, I think, is the lesser of the ways in which this description, powerful and beautiful as it is, fails. The deeper one is that often poskim have to make decisions that impose sacrifices on others that either they know they wouldn't be able to live up to, or that they simply have no idea. You know, if you make a decision that you're unable to free a specific aguna, you don't know whether you could live that way, and you've never been through that. So how do you know? And that applies to, you know, to issues which aren't, which, you know, issues of sexual orientation, all sorts of things like that. There are situations where poskim have to make decisions without either knowing for sure that they could bear the sacrifice they're asking from others, or even anyway knowing the sacrifice they bear from others. That doesn't mean that you can't poskim. Right? It doesn't mean you don't have an obligation to paskin, but it's not right. But it's too easy to say that. Well, the moral challenge is whether you can ask of others what you right, what you already are confident you can withstand yourself. Right? So I wanted to put that on the table and be aware that, you know, that on the issues we're talking about, to the extent that whatever I would say halakhically affects other people's lives in many ways, it will affect them in ways that I can't. That I can't say I would be able to bear, and that I can't say that I know exactly what it is. Right? I do my best to be honest about halakha, and I think that that's still my job. But on the other hand, I think that it's fair to acknowledge that up front. Okay, let's talk about what halakha can and can't do. So there is a sugya that I like to tell my students is far and away the most dangerous Talmudic passage there is. And you should be aware that I'm offering you enormous trust by teaching it to you, because it's really very, very dangerous. Okay, that's on page 4. The Talmud is dealing with the question of under what circumstances you can, under what circumstances a woman is allowed to remarry on the basis of a ruling that her prior husband was dead. Right, what's our evidentiary standard? So the Mishnah writes a rather odd line. It says, right, what happens if she made a mistake? So the Mishnah says that if she was married on the basis of a Beit Din ruling and her husband turns up alive, so she has to get divorced, but she doesn't have to bring
from the second one.
But she, thank you. But she doesn't have to bring a sacrifice because she relied on Beit Din. But if she remarried on her own, then she has to get divorced, but she still has to bring a sacrifice. But what does it mean to marry on her own? So the Gemara says it's not what you would think, that she went off on her own without any authorization. What it means is that there was so much evidence perfect evidence. Two male Shomer Shabbos witnesses testifying that they saw the body. And in such a case, even though she there's no way anybody could claim that she did anything wrong, she relied on the best testimony imaginable, she still has to bring her own sacrifice. Because she didn't rely on Beit Din. And Beit Din did nothing, right? All that happened, right? She relied on what anybody else would do, is just relying on the facts. Right? So the suggestion is that when somebody relies on facts that anybody could make a decision based on it, then the Beit Din is irrelevant. All the Beit Din doing is ratifying something everybody knew. Now, then, in the Gemara, Ze'iri comes up with a claim which is even wilder. He says that it's not just that if a person gets married on the basis of the facts, you don't need Beit Din. It's what happens if somebody gets married on the basis of a Beit Din ruling that turns out to be in factual error. So he says, he gives an example as follows. He says, what happens if people do malacha on Shabbat because Beit Din said Shabbat is over? And then the sun comes out, and it turns out it was just cloudy. So Ze'iri says, in such a case, people have to bring their own sacrifice. Even though the Beit Din told them Shabbat was over, they have to bring their own sacrifice. They can't blame it on the Beit Din and say the Beit Din should bring the sacrifice because after all, they told us what to do. And the plain implication, according to Ze'iri, is, and that's basically the way we paskin halacha, is that when there is no legal judgment involved at all you're trying to do is determine the facts on the basis of evidence available to everybody as much as to you. So law has no, right, halacha has no authority over that. That's just reality. Now, the reason this is really dangerous is because every determination of law requires the application of a principle to a fact. Right? If you want to convict somebody of murder, you have to claim the right. Not only you have to claim that that killing is wrong, right? That's principle. You also have to claim that this was a person who was alive and is now dead. And if you'd allow people to say, "I'm sorry, you know, I agree with you that murder is wrong, but I think that person that was not a person," right? Let's say in Asimov, there's a whole series which is built on the premise that you can't tell whether it's a person or a robot. That's being murdered, right? So that's becoming more and more realistic nowadays. So if we take Ze'iri's position, so it gets complicated. As the Gemara says, because if a woman gets remarried on the basis of one witness, so that's a rabbinic decision to accept evidence that would not ordinarily be acceptable. So that requires law. But when all halachists are doing is looking at the same evidence as everybody else and making a decision on the basis of the same evidence as everybody else without any legal determinations as to what the standards of evidence are, then it has no authority. No difference between somebody saying it's halacha and anybody else. So that's really dangerous. And I say, you can't have halacha about anything unless to some extent you allow poskim to determine facts. At the same time, you have to recognize that, you know, if it turns out that the facts are just completely wrong, then really there was no authority in it in the first place. If it turns out it was just cloudy, and the rabbis of the great Beit Din just made a dumb mistake, who cares? So with that, all right, so let's be aware that on the issues that we have been talking about, we'll talk about tonight, obviously there are questions of law and there are questions of fact. And the questions of law in many ways depend on one's beliefs about the facts. To some extent, those are psychological facts, which are almost impossible to verify one way or the other. To some extent, those are empirical facts about the way people behave in society, which unfortunately right now there seems to be very little way of knowing what they are, although they are in principle obtainable. And there's no way to talk about Torah and Halacha without in some way expressing opinions about facts. At the same time, you know, I'm going to try and limit the extent I do that as much as I can. And you should recognize that to the extent that anything I say depends on opinions about facts, so that is, you know, discountable, because I don't have any particular authority at all about facts, whatever authority I might have in the area of halacha. Okay. There's a particular issue about that in our topic, which makes it, I think, harder, which is that in many ways there are differences in perception of fact that are generational. That's here. I'm making a claim about fact, right? So that, you know, and you can decide if you think it's compelling or not. That in many ways, the older you are, the more likely you are to have a particular perception of the facts about the extent to which certain notions of identity are innate, about the relationship between sex and gender, right? Some of those are opinions about morals, and some of those are opinions about facts. And I think we have to acknowledge the reality that in many cases these disputes end up being generational, and to think about what we do about generational differences of both morals and facts. So I gave you two stories on the Makorot where Jewish tradition addresses generational disputes. One is the in the aftermath of the death of King Solomon, Rehavam succeeds, and he consults initially, right? And the question is, what tax policy should he pursue? And really, a tax policy is not just economic tax policy. It also means what sort of labor levies you should pursue. And in many ways, it's generally a question of whether he should pursue a semi-totalitarian policy or a liberal policy about the nature of the state. And he goes to the elders, and the elders tell him that at least at the outset, you can read the story right and decide for yourself, at least at the outset, he should present himself as liberalizing after Solomon. And if he presents himself as liberalizing after Solomon, then the people will follow him for the rest of his lives and everything will be great. You can treat their advice cynically, or you can treat it as substantively as expressing what his relationship with the people should be. He goes to the youngsters he grew up with, and the narrator is very kind of sharp, Yiladim Asher Gadalit, right, really the children that he grew up with, and they say, just pile it on. Right? People need to show your tough. Don't smile until the fourth year of your reign, whatever it may be. For those of us who are in education, know what the advice is. And he follows the advice of the children. There's a fairly graphic and crude image in which he describes himself as tougher than his father. And the result of it is that 9.5 tribes leave. And he doesn't have any capacity to bring them back. So the Davidic reign ends over Israel, right? The Davidic monarchy keeps authority over Judah and the affiliated 2.5 tribes. 9.5 tribes form the kingdom of Israel, and that's the rest of the Nevi'im Rishonim. So the question I want to ask those of you who are here in Chavruta, whose fault was it that Rehavam made the wrong decision? So you think it's Rehavam's fault, because he should have followed the advice of the elders and not the advice of the young people. Would you have said that 20 years ago?
Studying Shakespeare
20 years ago, so yes. Uh-huh.
This is about how power works.
Uh-huh.
And the nature of the nature of monarchy, and that's something
Shakespeare thinks that's
successful.
So you don't think it's not generational at all. It's just that the, it happens that
the young people are fools.
The young people are fools.
They think that the way that power works is through force, and that's not how power works.
Uh-huh.
And that's what Rehavam is, a very appealing claim about power. I can force you. I have a lot of force.
Do you think that's a mistake of youth?
I think it's a naive reading of power. So I think it's,
uh-huh.
To some degree. I think it's whatever you want to say, naivete, experience.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, Jacob, what do you want to say?
So one thing, and I'll start my coverage with this, one thing we noted in coverage is it's not just the youth. It's the youth that he grew up with. It's almost like he's surrounded, he wants to hear from the yes men and sycophants. And it's not necessarily about generational, it's about the people who will say yes to him.
Aha. Okay, so you're still blaming him. Because he because he doesn't want to hear it. Is he just listens to the people who say what he wants to do anyway? and he's not actually consulting. Okay, Sophia, what do you want to say?
He was also inheriting a broken system, right? He's not the one who decided to have all these new these tax rules. It was his father. And so he's inheriting a broken system, and also one in which he's not being chosen based off of his merit, right? We would hope that if we're going to compare this to rabbis or any kind of rabbinic decisor, that they would be chosen based off of their merit. I would like to think their rabbis don't have absolute power in the same way and like wouldn't need a group of yes men in order to pump them up. And so he's inheriting a broken system, and also hopefully a person of who is wise will be able to discern wisdom from both young people and old people. And also God wanted this to happen, right? Like this was...
Yeah, I cut out those psukim because that's cheating that God wanted it to happen. Yeah.
So obviously it's a helpful excuse, right? It could be, it's a helpful, it's still, you know, an important plot point that it's about youth, but also it's something about how change is going to happen anyway. So where's it going to be coming from?
Uh-huh. Okay. So I have never actually taught this story, so I'm really very tentative. But reading it as I thought of it as the Makor for tonight, I thought that part of what Sophia says, I think I agree with entirely, which is let's recognize that taxes are already very high. Right? The end of Solomon's reign is straight out of Devarim, all the things a king shouldn't do. Those are the things that Solomon does. That's the end of his reign, right? Which Chazal and one of their cooler versions, right, say that it's not really Solomon; it's really the demon Ashmedai, right, who's sitting on the throne for the second half of Solomon's reign, and that's why, right, that's why everything goes wrong. But right, the second half of Shlomo's reign is right is literally a counter to the verses in Deuteronomy of what kings shouldn't do. He has too much money, He has too many. He sends to Egypt for horses, right? Everything he has, right? He has 1,000 wives. Right, basically everything counter halacha. So that's A, right? It's not right. So Rechavam is raised in a system where all the norms that are supposed to produce a good monarchy have already broken down. And then the way I understood the Hayildim Asher Gadal Itam is he's raised in a bubble. I don't know that he thinks he wants yes men. It's just unimaginable to him that anybody outside his circle will be right.
So why does he approach the elders first?
Because he knows he's supposed to, right? He knows he's supposed to go back to the elders, but he doesn't, right? But he can't. But they can't communicate with him at all, because he grew up, right? He grew up in this bubble, right? We won't, characterize exactly what the parallel in the dirty is, but he grew up in this bubble of young people, right, for whom the advice of elders is utterly irrelevant, right? That's another way I think of reading the story. And the third thing is that, and it's also true, that his father and the elders did nothing for A. Right, they're telling him to change policy. Well, where were the elders in Solomon's reign? Telling him to change policy. And they have no prior relationship. The only relationship they have is that they're his father's counselors. So I think that to blame it just on Rechavim is way too facile. Right, there's a complete breakdown of generational communication. And then the question is, okay, so granted that that's what happened when Rechavim took over as king, what could the elders have done to change it? Right, if you acknowledge that communication has already broken down, right, what can you do? So I want to leave with that because I think that's an important question to think about. You can't absolve the elders, and yet you have to think, what's the strategy? Right, if you know that here's this person raised in this bubble. If you tell them something that doesn't conform to their presuppositions, they're going to dismiss it. Can you do it? Right? Is there anything that you can do to avert the disaster? Second story I gave you was Akavya ben Mahalalel, who I'll recognize my biases. Akavya ben Mahalalel is one of my heroes. Akavya ben Mahalalel holds the Mishnah. Right? This is the source A, right? On page one, all right, yeah. On page one, right, Akavya ben Mahalalel holds four legal positions, and his fellows tell him, recant the four things that you hold, and we will give you some kind of position. I put it in the footnotes, you'll know, right, that it may be, the position they offer him is Av Beit Din, which is number two. Don't know what would have happened if they'd offered him number one. But they offered him number two. Number two he's not interested in. And he holds his position. They put him in Cherem. There's a version in which he dies in Cherem. They stone his they stone his coffin. Another person says, no, that can't possibly be, but that seems to be the standard version, is that they keep him in Cherem and they stone his coffin. Which doesn't mean, by the way, they don't like him or talk to him. Excommunication is, in Talmudic times, is a very complicated thing. It means that you can't talk to people the way you talk to other people, but there are always ways around it. Right? One has to be careful about that. You can always have, for example, one of the stories that my daughter grew up thinking was her favorite story in the Talmud, when they throw people out of the Beit Midrash, and so the people outside of the Beit Midrash make paper airplanes and throw them back in with their questions. And then the students inside the Beit Midrash read the questions of the paper airplanes and ask the questions to their teachers, who can't answer them. So at some point, the students look at the teachers and say, Torah is outside and we're inside, so they're backwards here. And so the teachers have to let the guys they threw out back in. Otherwise, the students will leave. But there's always a way for communication to keep on happening. The Kaviyah Mahalel is officially persona non grata, because he holds these four positions. We don't know what's important about these four positions. And that's, in itself an interesting question. They seem like they're minor positions, but presumably they were not minor positions. Presumably they in some way reflected things that were crucial in that society. We know like one of them becomes a big deal about whether, it sounds trivial about whether you can give a woman who is a convert, whether you can make her go through the Sota ritual. But it turns out that everyone knows that Shmaya and Avtalion did do this. But at least one interpretation is that Akavim Mahalo held that they did that only because they themselves were converts and they were showing favoritism to converts. And so the accusation, right? So they were really, that was really a very powerful accusation, and they got thrown out because of the, because they were implying that halacha was not purely objective, right? So there are all sorts of ways in which specific the positions may have been much more socially resonant than we know now. On his deathbed, Akavim Mahalal calls over his son and says, by the way, I think you should not hold the four positions that I held. And that's it. And it's right. And he says to his son, why? His son says, if you don't think I should hold them, why do you hold them? And he gives him an epistemological answer. Say, when I heard these four positions, it was an even argument. Right? Some people, right? There were lots of people who held my position, lots of people held the other position. And so I had just as much right as everybody else. But by now, by the time you come around, I am an obvious minority figure. And you don't have a right, halachically, to follow an obvious minority, even if it's your father. And we don't know what his son thinks. It seems from the story that his son is probably in utter shock, because he's thought that his father's position is absolutely like defining. And he intended to go through life, as the person who held his father's positions, and assume that would be what give his life meaning, that he would be holding his father's banner forever. And then his father tells him, all those things, right? And probably Kaviyah Mahalal's son has to deal with being in Cherem in school too. Your father's in Cherem, right? The other kids are not necessarily nice to you. And he's gone through all this. And then again, his father tells him, nope. Only, while I'm alive, yeah, okay, I guess, right, that you can follow me. But I'm dead. After I'm dead, you should just change and just join the majority. That's a wild thing also. And what's really interesting is, does Akavim Mahalal give up his faith that he's right? I don't think so. But he tells his son that his son has to go along with a position he knows to be wrong, and a position that his son knows to be wrong. Because there are certain ways in which you just, certain things you stand alone for, and certain things you don't. Because the system is entitled to have its own epistemology. And even though I think this is true, but in your generation, no one else thinks it's true. I don't know if his son should listen to him. That's another thing I think that's worth reflecting on, right? His son should listen to him only, I suspect, if his son was only following his positions because he didn't believe them. But if his son believed them himself, why should he give in? I think the story is really complicated It seems to be about a space in which positions that were perfectly ordinary in one generation then got excluded, became minority positions then we're excluded by force. And then the exclusion by force was successful to the point, right, to the point that that it becomes, you know, it becomes completely out of bounds to hold them anymore. So it could be that teaches you that you should go along, or it could be that teaches you know that obviously this is illegitimate. Right? Any position that it took putting people in harem to keep out, which had once been legitimate, so you should have an idealistic desire to keep alive. Right? Correct. So I think there's, I think, not obvious to me that Akavim Mahalalel's son should listen, and I began by telling you that Akavim Mahalalel is one of my heroes, not his son. And the truth is, we don't hear anything about his son, ever. This is the only story which his son appears. Because who cares about him? He just says what everyone else says. Right? His son, and his son asks him, will you at least give me a letter of recommendation to your peers? And his father says, no. Right? You'll have to go on your own merit. No legacy admissions to the Sanhedrin. even if you agree with the positions that everybody thinks you have to say in order to get into the Sanhedrin. So I think that Akav Hal is one of my heroes because he says no. And there are ways in which you can see him as like the only honest man in the whole society, because his colleagues are ready to bribe him with office. In order to stop his position, and when he turns down the bribe, then they use force. All right, so you can leave it that way. There is a redeeming feature, but we don't paskin that way. Right, the Gemara goes further. Gemara says, but shouldn't Akavi Mahalalel be a zakin mamre? He's going against the majority. Shouldn't they execute him? So the Gemara gives two answers. One answer is he only held his position theoretically. That seems very unlikely, although it solves the problem logically. And the other is at least they had the integrity not to kill him. Right, but there's a dispute about whether they're allowed to do that or not. I always like that position. That that at the end of the day, they recognize that there is a real value in having somebody who is uncorruptible, even if they hold incorruptible, right? Even if they hold positions that really disturb you. So I prefer that, but I have to acknowledge that the formal halakha does not adopt that position. Formal halakha is that the Sanhedrin is required to execute a zaken mamre. But I think we can live with that. It's probably a theoretical formal halachic position. Hold on. Is it important now, right, to ask it now?
Well, I'll ask the questions and you just...
Okay. Sure. Okay. Yeah.
The first one is, I guess it's Rashi. Do you not kind of hold by that, where he says, lest people say he recanted because of authority? That had nothing to do with the positions at all. He didn't feel strongly one way or the other. It was that he didn't want people to think that this person is representative of,
Well, that's not Rashi. It's in the Mishnah. The question, right? But it's not clear to me that he thought that, or that's what the Mishnah gives as a rationale for his position. That's why I left it. I indented it because I wasn't sure whether it's right, whether he's saying that or whether he just held his position and then they say he was afraid people would think that, right? Because I'm not sure that's actually what his position is.
And then the second question was just, how do you differentiate between this situation and the previous one?
Yeah.
By Rehavam, where the situation got broken because, people didn't listen to each other. And here, the situation got broken because people didn't listen to each other. But here, Rehavam was certainly not a hero, and Akavia is. So where's the difference?
Yeah, that's a great, because Rehavam has no, right, isn't turning anything down. He suffers no consequences for his, and he's not iconoclastic. He just goes with one group against another. Right? There's no consequences at all, as far as he knows. Right, he turns out to be wrong. There are consequences that he didn't expect, but there's no heroism in Rehavam's position that I can tell. Right, there's no sacrifice. There's no right. He doesn't even know it's a risk. Okay, I just leave it because I don't want to have clarity coming out of it. This is good because it made me think about Malachim in a way I haven't thought about in a long time. But I just be frank that to me this is one of the hardest things about dealing with this issue is the generational gap between with my students, with my children, where it seems hard sometimes even to have basic communication about the issue. And that I think is one of the beautiful things that's happened in this Beit Midrash. Is that people who held different things across different generations were capable. I think beautiful things is watching chavruta that are cross generational, watching people whom I know hold very different positions because of what they tell me during the week outside of share, but the reactions before and afterwards. I think that's part of what the Beit Midrash is supposed to do, is be able to hold that, to create a space and hold that space where people can communicate, and then see what happens. Okay, that's part two. Let's move on to something closer to substance, right? So this is week four, substance of this issue, right? In week one, we went through issues of cross-dressing, and what I think emerged was, somewhat to my surprise, that you couldn't actually clearly state what the halakha was or why, that there seemed to be two very opposite strands, one of which said that really the halakha was just about preventing certain kind of sexual liaisons and had no real interest in establishing gender roles other than for the purpose of preventing certain kinds of sexual liaisons. And another which seemed to, where the outcomes seemed to be have much more ambitious aims, and couldn't find consistency in any person at all. I saw, which I had not seen at the time of the first year, that the Minchas Chinuch basically just throws up his hands and says, well, it could be that it's rational and it's all grounded in trying to prevent certain sexual liaisons, or it could be it's just a gzeirat ha-katuv, and we have no idea what's going on here. And that sort of leads to arbitrary halakha. It doesn't help you any really much at all. That's, I think, what came out, you know, and so there were really important nafkaminas. One is whether you ban people from wearing cross-gender clothing, even if it's evident that you're not, that to everybody that what your biological sex is, despite your gender. Another was unisex clothing. I didn't mention halacha, but I will now, that certainly where I was coming from was a tshuva by Rav Avadya Yosef, in which he takes a very, very strong position that unisex clothing is permitted. Right, so I always took that as a fundamental grounding, even though there are those who disagree. The two poskim I basically read thoroughly in contemporary were somewhat degree thoroughly or Rav Moshe and Rav Avadya Yosef. So I read this tshuva of Rav Avadya Yosef when I was young, and you know, I've always assumed that that was correct. But you know, it's a machloket, but I think one can certainly rely on that, and I think there are places where that is useful. In the second week, we talked about the Tzitz Eliezer's position about surgery, and what I established to my own satisfaction, at least, not entirely a Taig satisfaction, if I recall correctly, that the Tzitz Eliezer does not relate in any way to what is currently called sex reassignment surgery. That the Tzitz Eliezer is dealing with surgery that is still imaginary, although it may become possible some days, in which the result of surgery is actually to create some degree of functionality of the of the opposite sex, whether that is for reproduction or sex or whatever, whatever the standards of that may be. And those sorts of things are more likely nowadays, or the extent they happen hormonally as opposed to surgically. But the Tzitz Eliezer does not take the position sometimes attributed to him that all that matters is the appearance of external genitalia, even if one knows that they're artificial and non-functional. I can say now that I have a letter from Rav David Cohen from 1975 that was privately given to me, in which he states exactly the same thing. So it's not a 2023 chiddush of mine. We can show, you know, that 48 years ago, Sirius Poskim already took that position without bothering to mention that Sicily Ezra is saying something else, because I think that was correct, because he didn't. I talked about the Rav Eliashiv said the same thing. I'd love to quote modern Orthodox Poskim at you, but there aren't any that I know of that address the question. In volume one, Rabbi J. David Bleich, my teacher, has an essay in which he largely, I think, says the same thing. That, to me, is the upshot of the second shir. It doesn't tell you what the halacha is. You could decide that is the correct halacha, even though the Tzitz Eliezer didn't say it. But I don't think you can say it. I think it'd be wrong, flat out wrong, to say that that is the position of the Tzitz Eliezer. But I'll qualify it. But it's not wrong to say that other poskim, who when people take seriously, such as Dr. Avraham Steinberg, think that was the position of the Tzitz Eliezer. What I don't know is anybody who both thinks that is the position of the Sicilianer and thinks that the Sicilianer is right. Right? There are people who think that is the position of the Sicilianer and the Sicilianer is wrong, and there are people who think that's not the position of the Sicilianer. For example, when I was a freshman in NYU, my teacher, Rabbi Mordechai Willig, taught that the Sicilianer and described it as a Shigigah Yotzei Mipi HaShalit, which is a rabbinic image for, like, wow, everyone, you know, as Fiorello LaGuardia said, if I'm going to make a mistake, it's a doozy. Right, so that was pretty much his impression of that Sicilianer, right? That was a mistake. Right? He's a great figure, and that was a doozy. Again, since there are no positions defining what would constitute a shift in biological sex, so you can't say it's wrong just because Sicilianer didn't say it. The Sicilianer does establish that he doesn't have an a priori belief that biological sex is unchangeable. Since he records all sorts of events that, you know, that we treat as supernatural, of people changing biological sex. So, right, you can argue that Sicilianer establishes that there is in fact a possibility, and now we're just arguing about the standard. I think that is correct. But we should have the conversation about standard, I think, from scratch, not on the basis that Sicilianer has already established it. And we can go further and say, and if that matters to you, Rav David Cohen and Rav Yashiv both rejected that understanding of Sicilianer out of hand. Okay. So, all right, in the third week, we went through the Dor Tapuchot, which is still the only full-length treatment of Halachot of transsexuality. There was some dispute among the fellows as to whether the Dor Tapuchot has functioned as a positive force for people who are transsexuals' inclusion in the community, and whether people see it as a reasonable basis for functioning, or whether actually it is a source of great alienation. I think that, like the Sicilianer, it's often misrepresented as if the Dor Tapuchot has a distinction that tracks what we call the distinction between sex and gender. Actually, it seems that all he has is a distinction between sex and erotic attraction. And all his, right, all the halachot that he thinks depend on appearance are really just a question of whether somebody is erotically attracted to the person or not. And that is based on false, so far as we can tell, assumptions about post-surgical sexual orientation, and in general, assumptions about the universality of sexual orientation, which are not of heterosexual orientation, which you can make a legal presumption about, but you can't claim as a position of fact. And in terms of surgical or hormonal treatments altering sexual orientation, the evidence for that seems at this stage minimal. Right? That just seems essentially not true. And the Dor Tapuchot also has no sympathy or justification at all for any attempts at altering one's biological sex. He deals with a hypothetical, but in his case, a real life Bala Tshuva, who has made irreversible changes, and the question is what to do now. But he has no sympathy whatsoever for anybody who wishes to undergo such changes, to the point where in a later tshuva he paskins that it's yehareg vel yavor, even people whose lives might be in danger because of a risk of suicide if they don't engage in it, right, are not allowed to have the surgery, which is a pretty astounding ruling, I think. Rav David Cohen, I should say, also took a very similar position in 1975. So that did not seem to me to be a constructive way forward. We pointed out, though, is that the Dor Tapuchot has a pragmatic effect that may be worthwhile, is that by accident, in certain ways, he allows people to function socially as the gender they appear as, even though his ground for that is a set of assumptions about sexual orientation and attraction that don't seem empirically correct, and certainly is not based on any notion of gender as distinct from sex. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to, at this point, right, I'm going to make claims that are entirely on my own authority, which is where I end up, and then based on those claims, which are eminently challengeable, I want to offer two models for going forward. And then, you know, at that point, I'll take whatever the questions or tomatoes are from the audience. I noticed, you know, tomatoes are easy to hide. You know, bouquets of flowers seem noticeably absent. People don't seem quite prepared. But perhaps all the flowers are, you know, all the roses are next door the way you have them, you know, at operas, whatever it may be. Perhaps someone has a concession set up. I should have asked Emuna, right, to prepare all the bouquets so people could buy them at the end of this year. Okay, so here's I think that we should say, even though I'm clear again that I can't prove this, I think we should say that cosmetic surgery and or the removal of sexual reproductive organs do not alter halachic biological sex. I think it's important to make that statement. Right? It doesn't mean there isn't something else that could, but cosmetic surgery and or the remove, right? You know, I don't want to say just cosmetic surgery because there's surgery which involves removal of all sorts of organs. Removal, we saw one position, right, where, you know, we remove all the male organs and you're a woman, right? We're not going to take that position. I think we should state really clearly that the forms of surgery that are currently available have no halachic effect on that level. The reason I think that it's important to say this loudly and clearly without the hedges that I often give when I make halachic positions is because of what we call legally as reliance issues. That people make life decisions based on the belief that a certain position is legitimate within halacha. And if you haven't been absolutely clear that this position is out of bounds and no one will support it, then they can come to you and say, look, you didn't tell me it was out of bounds. I made a decision thinking it was reasonable. Now you're declaring it unreasonable. That's not fair to me. Then they're right. Right? They're right. If you haven't said, you know, as clearly as possible, this position has no weight, then they're entitled to say, right, well, I thought it was just a minority position, but I would still be functioning, you know, I would still be, you know, functioning perfectly reasonably within the Orthodox community if I followed it. So I want to make, and I think we should all make that position as clearly as possible, that there is no current mode of surgery that has any effect on halachic sex at all. Okay, second claim, which is much more radical, is I think that we should make a distinction between dysmorphia and dysphoria. Dysmorphia is when a person is uncomfortable with their body, right, which means that they're uncomfortable with their biology, right? They feel that they are in a body which is of the wrong biological sex, and that is utterly divorced from any notion of what the expectations in society are of behavior, right, of behaviors based on having that body. Dysphoria is a position, right, where one is deeply uncomfortable with the social expectations that one has, and those social expectations are often very much tied societally, sometimes arbitrarily, and sometimes for very good reason, to one's body. But I think it's very important to distinguish among them, among other things, because dysmorphia is something that one can explain by Kabbalistically and things, right, in other forms, by saying, okay, what you have is a soul of type A born into body of type B. And that, I think, we should, to the extent what people can make such a claim, I think it's clear that they, you know, that it's clear that that is a claim that is recognized in Jewish tradition. It doesn't change the halakha, which everyone acknowledges the halakha is grounded in the, you know, in body, you know, obligations and things like that are grounded in body and not in soul. But it means that you're supposed to do everything you can to accommodate. Right, so I think that's one kind of case, as opposed to gender, which is not about, I think, I don't think you can explain gender dysphoria on the basis of souls. Right, gender dysphoria is a social construct, and we can talk about, right, I think, right, the second thing that follows from that, which is that we should not paskin, if at all possible, in ways that could motivate people to have surgery as a way of having access to different forms of gender performance. I think that the job of PSAK should be that people should make decisions about their bodies without thinking about the ways in which that would give you more, right, few, more a different halachic axis. What you have, the way you relate to your body is one thing, and then the kind of gender performance you want is something else, and we should enable, as much as possible, we should enable those decisions to be made independently. In order to do that, we have to make as a default assumption, which is problematic for some people I recognize, that most halachic differences between men and women are rooted in biological sex rather than gender. And then we can say, since surgery doesn't alter biological sex, it's not going to change any of those things. Right? If you think that the differences are rooted in gender, so then, right, then it might be that if changing your appearance changes the way people react to you, then it would have lots of halachic impact as well. So, for example, as we talked about, I think that that the Dor Tapuchot's conclusion that trans men can receive aliyot and shul is very poor policy. Even though it's certainly halakhically justifiable, it's also halakhically justifiable to say that women can get aliyot also. It just happens not to be where the Orthodox community is. So I don't think it's justifiable from an authority perspective, but it's certainly justifiable from an intellectual perspective. So you could do that all, but I think it'd be very, very poor policy if you underwent this surgery, right, then we would allow you to get aliyot. I think that would be a very poor policy. Okay, so those are two things. But I think that there's a third thing which is really important, which is, given those two presumptions, we should try to create as much possibility within halakha for variation of gender expression. Right, we should try to box people in. Now you can say what our default is and what happens when people raise specific issues of dysphoria. You can narrow that and say, when people express or diagnose, whatever you want to call it, as having gender dysphoria, so as opposed to our reaction, halacha has these tight boxes and we need to stuff you into those tight boxes. And our only question is whether we're going to allow you to live outside the halachic boxes because you have a psychological illness or something like that. I don't think that's the right approach. I think the approach I want to suggest is we should figure out, okay, where is all the space we can give you to be perfectly within the box of halacha and nonetheless express who you think you are? Right? That's why I think the position that would say that you can, that people can wear clothing of the other gender as long as they identify their biological sex, right? And it's possible that there are ways in which that could eventually become in the way in which we deal with other sorts of issues, that that there are ways in which you can have joint therapeutic rabbinic teams working out what the parameters of things like that are. I think that's one, and I think that that's where the value of the first shiur really is, that there's much more space for that. Whether you think it's an ideal or whether you think it's a concession, but it's in halacha. I think that we should try to create as much space as possible for people who express their discomfort with the current ways in which we require gender expression in the Orthodox community. Okay, I want to make hold on. I want to make three other broad claims. It'll be 9:30, and I'll take questions. The first is, generally, a community has to decide whether it's a community which is organized around a certain set of specific performances and ideals, and either and it's an our way or the highway community, or it's a community which has has inclusion as a value, and it thinks that there's a virtue in having people who don't exactly fit. We might have aspirational ideals, but we want to create space in the community for people who do not live up to our aspirations and don't even necessarily even share those aspirations, so long as they want to belong to a community that has those aspirations. I think that Yisrael of Sharon has defined itself, in all my experience, as a community for which inclusion is a value that way, and we ought to on this issue as well. I want to make two other points. One is, there's a Rambam that I think, this is page 6. All right, so Rambam in the Guide to Perplex says, among the things that you likewise ought to know is that the Torah does not consider the individual, and the command was not given with a view to the minority of cases. Rather, in everything that is desirable to accomplish, be it an outlook or a character trait or an action that is effective, only the things that are a majority are considered, and no attention is paid to something that rarely occurs, nor to the damage that will occur to an individual human because of that decree in Torah governance. For the Torah is a divine thing, and therefore you can learn about it from natural things, where the general utilities found in them include and necessarily entail private damages. Right? There are, right, the weather is set up, and weather is really good on the whole for human survival. Climate is really good for human survival, but there are tsunamis. Okay, there are thunderstorms and there are lightning strikes. And the Rambam says that halacha functions like the laws of nature. There are lightning strikes. There are lightning strikes in halacha. And he goes on to say, right, halacha is formulated that way. Right, it's explicitly formulated. It should be formulated generally. But what I'd argue, and I don't have the time to make the argument in depth, but anyone emails me, I'm happy to send you the version, right, the audio where I make the argument in depth, that the job of practical halachas, in many ways, is to try and put up lightning rods and seawalls and things like that so that the halacha is preserved exactly as it is, and there's a lot less private damage. Okay, right, and I think that is, right, so recognize that halacha is not going to work for everybody. One of the ways which halacha is not going to work for everybody is that halacha sets up certain kinds of gender rigidities that don't work for everybody. And so the job of a posek, or the job of a halachic community, because again, I don't think that poskim are these unique beings who have experiences that no one else has, is to try and create a community where there are lightning rods and seawalls for the people, where even though halacha is the right way, right, for the community, we should recognize that that's going to have costs and do our best to mitigate those costs. So that's one model where you can create, I think, lots of space, and it goes hand in hand with the model I'm talking about, creating as much space as possible halachically for gender expression. Right, even if you think that's not what most people should do, but that might be what we need to do to have this person not get hit by lightning. Second thing, which is much more speculative, is that Rav Soloveitchik, in his book Halachic Morality, which is the posthumous book that I think is you should read. Generally, I think you can read all the things that were, that you're much better off reading the things that were published before his death. But Halachic Morality has lots of really cool stuff in it. I know people argue with me, especially about the evolution of ethical man. So I will not, I will acknowledge the disagreement. But to me, Halachic Morality is the book you got to read. This that's posthumous. Everything else you can get, is entailed in the original books. So in Halachic Morality, he makes the claim that there's halacha as law, which covers general situations. And then there's halachic morality. We call it halachic morality, but it means morality. that comes not out of abstract principles, but comes from immediate religious experience. All right, it's an interpretation of religious experience in the moment. I want to argue that also means human experience. So I set up, I gave you another source, where we talked about an interesting conflict where the Gemara tries to draw a line between Darchei Shalom, which means you have to treat all human beings properly and politely and things like that. And part of being treating people naturally and politely is expressing interest and support for the activities they engage in. And the problem is that you're an Orthodox Jew, right? Let's say you're a fully observant Orthodox Jew, and you live in a community where if you engage in those sorts of normal interactions with the people around you, that will involve expressing interest and support for activities that you think are forbidden, because that's what people are doing. So the Mishnah tries to draw a very careful line. In some ways, it draws it you can be with them, right? Let's say we're worried that Amei Haaretz are not careful about being metame their flour, and that means that the challah that's in their flour, which you have to give to a kohen, which you have to keep Torah, becomes tame immediately. So you're allowed to be to work with the Amei Haaretz and talk to them all the way through until the moment when they add water, which makes it tame. Now, whether that actually works to create Darkei Shalom, when you're if you're up with them, sorry, I gotta go now, I don't know. What it does is, you know, the best way I think would be if there's a certain degree of transparency and everyone knows, right? You're trying to, right? You think there's a value in engaging with people as human beings in their own terms. And at the same time, they have, right, they have an obligation to respect your need to live up to your own values. And so I wanted to try and argue that maybe that boundary between what Mishnah calls Darkei Shalom and Mechazek Yedei Ovrei Avera, right, the boundary between ways of peace and Mechazek Yedei means even verbally encouraging people who are engaged in sin, is to some degree could be made parallel to the argument the Rav makes that morality means that kind of treating everyone with Darkei Shalom, right? That we understand like that's a genuine religious impulse that all human beings should be treated in the right among other, in the way they expect to be treated, and that means not challenging their identities if that's what's important to them, even if you think they're wrong. And at the same time, there are rules, and sometimes those two things come in conflict. But we should recognize that what we're trying to do is find a boundary between meeting people in the moment where there is a genuine basis in meeting people where they are in the moment, and at the same time, you have to have rules. And right, and it's really difficult to draw the line as to where when you're in the moment and when you're following rules. So that seems to me, right, those two together, right, offers a second model for trying to navigate a very careful boundary. Now, none of this has talked about the question of whether there are activities that would ordinarily be forbidden, but that because people need them for their mental health, whether for minor or extreme cases, right? Minor cases would be, you know, where it just creates ongoing discomfort, right? You know, and extreme cases would be where it actually threatens your life in the short or long term, whether for suicide risk or for other reasons. But it's true that once you acknowledge that there are things that people can do for their mental health, so then you have a ground in ordinary discourse saying, why are we, right? Once there's a way in which you could do it legally, so why is it our business to ask whether you did it for that reason or for some other reason, right? So that enables a kind of space in which a generous meeting assumes that a person has a valid reason for acting as they are. There's a loss in that, so long as activities done for mental illness are stigmatized, so that creates a presumption, you're creating a presumption that you're treating somebody as pathological. So it's not obvious that works well. But I think that that also has to be thrown in as a factor. And at the same time, we also have to be careful to be skeptical about claims. Right? We shouldn't assume halachically that we are required to accept every claim about the therapeutic effect of particular treatments. And I think it's very important for halacha, as every other discourse, not to be captured by particular claims of fact that may be generational and may not be grounded. You know, for example, I think it's always important to recognize that statistics about suicide attempts are not equivalent to statistics about suicide. The easy evidence of that, right, is that biological women attempt suicide far more than biological men. Biological men complete suicide far more than biological women. So there is no, right, so on a gendered level, it's obvious that there is no natural, no obvious correlation between reducing or increasing suicide attempts. Right, that's just as a simple example. I think in every area of mental health, we're aware, as by physical health, any area where you have where you're diagnosing a result as opposed without a cause, the diagnosis itself increases the rate of the rate in which it occurs, because now people have language for things that they didn't previously have language for, and it's easy to take part of that and then identify, well, you know, since some of my symptoms meet that, so I think we have to be very careful about that as well. And particularly in terms of gender-affirming care, we have to be very, very careful about what the statistical results of that actually are, and not to assume that we have to accept every claim on that in that regard. Retain skeptical. Maybe one of the things that halacha can contribute to the conversation is by making a very clear distinction between sex and gender in ways that are not, I think, part of contemporary discourse consistently. Okay, so summing up, right? I think you know where I come out is that we should be really clear again that cosmetic surgery and or removal of body parts cannot change halachic gender, but that right that we should be very leery of making halachic decisions that might encourage people to engage in such surgery in order to achieve different different halachic results, but that we should try very hard to create as much space as possible within halacha for people who find the boxes right the boxes halacha this creates for sex and gender, especially for gender confining, that we should recognize that as opposed to seeking I call like halachic hegemony over every aspect of the Orthodox community life, that there is space for saying that even within halachic life, we need to react to people as human beings and that it's reasonable to say, right, that there are moral principles which have religious value in treating people as they wish to be treated as opposed to as we, right, in accordance with the abstract boxes in which we place them. And that as in most areas, halacha has a lot more space for people who enter with goodwill, than one might have thought of, one might have thought entering it. Okay, at this point, I will happily take questions, tomatoes or roses, as chosen, preferably dethorned roses. Yes, Roger.
Are you banning surgery?
Am I banning surgery? I think that you know that it's clear generally that halacha bans unnecessary surgery, but the question of whether the surgery can be necessary is you know is an empirical mental health question, and I don't think it's you know there's any reason for halacha to decide that. I think that people make their best prudential judgments. What we can do is we can say we're not going to provide any incentives for that outside of mental health, and then leave it to people's judgment in that regard. I don't see any reason that I don't agree with the author of Dor Tapucho's conclusion that the surgery can't be prudent on any grounds. That seems to me to overreach. Okay. Yes, Maxine.
I just like a little bit of clarification on, you know, why you brought in the discrepancy between, you know, statistics for suicide attempts and, you know, completions. I'm not sure I got what the purpose was, and I don't know if, I mean, I know that...
Okay, I'll say it straight, because I think that there is often a... often an attempt to shut down halachic discourse by claiming either anecdotally or based on studies that if you rule a particular way, then you will increase the rate of suicide attempts. But usually people will say, right, if you do that way, then you will increase the rate of suicides. I think that it is generally not a good idea to allow halachic discourse to be shut down that way. And part of the way is to make clear that even if you could demonstrate an increase in attempts, that would not per se demonstrate that the effect of a particular halachic ruling is a higher rate of death.
Given if you could, you know, determine that, I think, you know, we still don't want people.
Okay, that's a different claim. I agree. You don't want people to attempt suicide either, right? That's also a bad outcome. But it's not the same thing as a claim that, you know, as a let's shut it down at Pikuach Nefesh argument.
Okay.
All right, and I think it's important to distinguish.
Yes.
Yes.
I think that if we have the data about whether or not it increases actual suicide, that your position makes a lot of sense. I also think that if we don't have the data, and we do have data about suicide attempts, then I think we should assume that suicide attempts track to suicide.
So that's an interesting claim, right? Which, you know, I think because, you know, unfortunately it creates perverse incentives in certain ways, mm-hmm. that's a, right, that that's a, in the same way as I think about surgery. I think that I think that there are high risks in argument like that. I think because sometimes these claims are circular, and that people then become persuaded that being in an environment where somebody says something like that is in fact right, is in fact increases the risk, it's actually unhealthy for people. So that's why I'm resistant to that. I think the argument is fair, but I hope it's clear why I resist it. Okay, other questions? Okay, yes, Tag.
It seems to me that there's a frame to the presentation that you've made that I think might miss something. You began this year by talking about a generational divide, that sort of us and them kind of divide that that makes this kind of conversation challenging. And then you presented the difficulty of having people that fall outside of this established gender binary, and how we can make how we can make life livable, resonant for the people who fall outside of that binary. But I think that the existence of people for whom the law does not work actually changes the way that we think about the law for everyone. For example, the existence of people who cannot bring their animals to the Beit HaMikdash to slaughter them changes our relationship, changes the relationship to meat for all of Am Yisrael, and creates the concept of chulin as opposed to just kadasha. And the existence of people for whom bringing the Pesach doesn't work for them changes the relationship of all of Am Yisrael to chametz and matzah, to the concept of the Pesach and what that korban means. The existence of the benot tzlofchad for whom the presumed laws of nachala do not work changes the relationship to Nachala and to inheritance for all of Am Yisrael. And I think the existence of the recognition of people for whom the gender binary doesn't work should give us pause to consider whether we as an entirety are being well served by the gender binary that Halakha is being created. And the analysis that you've presented, I think, leaves us all the more impoverished, and that actually this the reality that we exist in, whether it's a change in reality or whether it's a recognition of something that's been true all along, offers us an opportunity for all of us to think more deeply about what is gender and what effect does it have on our lives? How does it change the way that we think about the universe and relate to it? And so, just naturally, halacha would develop and capture those newly recognized realities. And I think that if we took that frame, we would think very differently about the analysis, rather than trying to figure out a way where we can plaster here, bandage there, in a way that will make life as livable, as resonant for these individuals as we can possibly capture.
So let's take, let's leave aside the question of whether I agree with the analysis about meat and the colon and things like that, which I'm sure would be fun to discuss at some other time. Let's be frank, right? And let's say this is a conversation across generations, right? And we're like good models where I'm 55. And you're not quite 55, and we have, right, and we have, I think, right, I have the application somewhere, and we have different perspectives. So there's no question that you can say, taking out this Rambam or Beklapper is a way to preserve the existing structure and yet come across as humane. And you could say, no, maybe the structure is wrong. That I think is a fundamental, you know, is a proper fundamental question, and I have not, in the context of this shir, expressed why I think it's better to do that as opposed to the alternative. And in many ways, I think, you know, the shirim I gave were sort of against the default, which was a much more rigid halacha, which assumed an absolute gender binary, as opposed to attempting to defend halacha against, let's say, a queer theory approach. Right? I think that's fair. I don't think that in the context of this year I can do that. But I'm frank that you're right. And I do that. Yeah. I'm frank that you're right. They could do it that way, and I'm not doing it that way, and I'm not doing it that way on purpose. Because I don't think that the halacha and Torah I recognize can survive that approach. But that I may end up being, you know, being a kavim ben halal. And and it may be that, you know, that in the end my children will, you know, maybe I'll even tell them they should abandon my positions if I'm the last one left, or maybe not, and maybe they should listen to me, maybe they shouldn't. But I'm frank, you know, that way, right? You know, that to that extent, I'll tell you, you know, I guess a story that's, I think, relevant to this, which matters a great deal to me. When I first became rabbi at Harvard Hillel, I brought Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, Zichrono Livracha, who was my teacher of philosophy, as a scholar in residence to Harvard Hillel. And he and I did a Friday night question Q&A with the students together. And it was fascinating to me because in all ways, in terms of intellectually and sensibility, it seemed like we were almost exactly the same person. And yet our answers were radically different because of the 30 years. Between us, the issues had changed. Right? And I think that, you know, it was obvious to me that had he been born 30, 40, 50 years later, whatever it took him to be, right, to be born, when I was probably 50 years later, he would have given the answers I had given. And I try very hard to be aware of that, that there are times in, you know, that sometimes the answers I give are just because I'm born that way. And sometimes, no, you're right, you really, like, you know, I think even, you know, when I was 18, I would not have taken that approach. So it could be I'm wrong. But I think that there's no doubt, you know, that had I been born 30 years later, I would probably be more liberal practically on a lot of these issues. I would create a lot more space, be more open. And I think that it's fair, you know, that's why I try very hard to have these conversations with lots of people who are younger than me, as well as people my own age, and the few people left who are older than me. But I don't think that's the case here. I think I would have resisted that approach even when I was a flaming liberal 30 years ago. But I could be wrong, because I think I always had a sense of what it required for something to be law, which I don't yet see how this can do. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's what's wrong is that I'm too rigid to be able to understand how it's possible to fit this in law. But I read the people who write it, even the people who are very good at it, and at the end of it, I just say, no, I don't get it. I don't get it. And there were people like that 30 years ago also on different issues who wrote that way. And I looked at it and I just don't get it. So I don't think that's all it is. Okay? Yes.
So there's a really interesting thing, I think, that comes out from the analysis and the way you presented this, not just in the context of trans issues, but also within cisgendered practice. So, you know, if you think of it this way, you would, in principle, walk into an Orthodox shul and see people on both sides of the machitza wearing tallis and tefillin. If I'm assuming that mitzvah seishah is not grama, would follow your biological sex and not necessarily your gender expression. Presuming that you sit on the side of the machitza, okay, fine, I've assumed a couple of things. But either way, you could presumably then have people with a gender expression on both sides, both gender expressions on both sides of the machitza. Or we have three, I'm sorry. Maybe I'm going too far here, but I think that the general concept of this starts to unpack the gendered expression of practice.
So I'm like, I'm not, you know, I think the, I can answer in detail, but I'm not sure I get the question. You know, I think that mechitza is, I think that, you know, that mechitza is not arbitrary, generally, right? Because the whole point, mechitza is obviously very closely linked to biological sex. And the only question is, you know, whether we should, right, whether we should make exceptions for particular reasons. I think mechitza is arbitrary. Talis and tefillin, I mean, you know, in Beskeri, you know, when I was 18, I wrote an article saying that women could wear tefillin, and I still think that. And that's,
There's a difference between could and should.
Yeah, so I think if you tell, right, I think that there, I think, you know, halakhically, I think that women who think that they ought to should certainly do so in private. Right, whether you do it in public or not raises other sorts of issues. So I don't have such a problem with saying that some of the ways in which we structure gender expression are arbitrary. I guess you asked the question. Yeah, right. I agree with you. In the same way, I think that there are cultures where skirts are masculine and cultures where skirts are feminine, and I don't see a reason to insist on one of them as opposed to the other beyond a particular social context. So yeah, in that sense, you know, if that's what the question was, yeah, okay, you know,
it wasn't a gotcha.
Yeah,
it was
in that sense, look, you know, and some things I think, you know, clearly should be unisex, like Talmud Torah, right? And I'm very, very, you know, strong about that I think that there should be no differences between men and women in the expression of Talmud Torah unless people choose to have them be different. So in that regard, yeah, if that's the question, if I'm understanding the question properly, I don't have a problem with that.
Creates an interesting reality in our communities.
Yeah, I think, you know, it may turn out that often does that that many people are very comfortable with the gender expression that matches their biological sex, and people, you know, sort of exaggerate the extent to which people have discomfort with that. And it turns out that you can create opportunities and people won't take them because people on the whole are comfortable. And that's a good thing to know also. That's a good thing. So, you know, I don't tend to be among those who think that if you just open up the possibility, I wished if you open up the possibility all of a sudden that, you know, there would be thousands of Orthodox women learning Talmud and Halakha on a very high level. It doesn't happen yet, but I'm still going for it. You know, I don't think that I'm not worried so much.
No, I think it's a cynical thing. I think it's actually really interesting from a perspective of if someone's doing something, they're doing it because.
Yeah, so again, I think that we should try, on the whole, we should try, that people are doing things religiously, sincerely, we should try to create space. There are times when socially there are reasons not to do that, but on the whole, I think that our default should be to create space as opposed to try to stamp it out. Okay, so you already got to ask one question. So, are there other questions? Yeah, sorry.
It seems to me that the titalias are theoretical surgery. Might not be so theoretical in 50 years or something like that.
Right.
What do you think about his analysis in the face of that?
I think it's very hard to deny that that Jewish tradition acknowledges the possibility that biological sex can shift during life. Right. So, yes, I think that it would be dishonest of me to declare in advance that there's nothing imaginable that human technology can accomplish that would get there. If it comes to the point, right, where somebody has take the full extreme case, right, somebody has fully operative sexual and reproductive organs of the gender opposite their born biology, and none of the that's the extreme case, sexual and reproductive organs they were born with. Okay. You know, does that mean their soul shifted, or do I want to claim no? Anybody who went through that obviously, right, you know, has a misplaced soul. Right? You can do whichever way you want. Right, I'm okay with that either way. And it could be that that we could establish a standard beneath that. Right, that could happen halakhically. I think there's a reasonable basis that surgery per se is not a positive. But, you know, I think that's a reasonable thing. Now, I've had people for very different reasons talk about particular surgeries that remove parts of their bodies, and said it was a great decision, not necessarily because they have trans issues, but, you know, people remove body parts because of fears of cancer, and things like that. And it might be that after you remove that part, you feel liberated, not because you were uncomfortable with your gender. Right. So I don't see any reason that I should paskin in advance that such surgeries would be ineffective halachically.
I don't clarify, but yeah. I didn't really mean surgery. I guess it'll probably be more of like a genetic therapy.
Whatever the things are, I don't see it. Right. You know, I think this doesn't work. We should be really clear. This doesn't work, and the Sisley Ezra didn't say it works, and it doesn't. Right. And then when the next thing comes up, then we should be perfectly clear one way or the other. Right, before we have people do things, right? You know, we should try it as rapidly as we can to develop consensus and create clarity for people. But you know, before those things happen, I don't see any reason that I should foreclose avenues that I don't have any experience of. I don't see it anyway. Yes, Brock.
Do you think the general approach you outlined here will take hold?
How would I know so in advance? Like, you know, I outlined it here. Obviously, tomorrow a million people listen to it on the internet, and then you know. The truth knows its own way, and so obviously, I expect to take at least 3 weeks, like all my other ideas, right? Some of which have taken even a month. I don't know. You know, there are times when I, you know, when things I've written, you know, have had influence, usually because people thought them already anyway. Right, and, you know, so just, you know, and very hard to know, and ideas I had that was really, really important to me that it's not clear that anyone else in the world, you know, remembers that I ever said them, and if they do, they don't think better of me for it. I don't know which one of those categories it will be. I think that at the least it should, you know, it should enable a conversation, and I hope it enables a conversation which everybody gets to say all the reasonable things that, right, that they believe, and then we'll see what happens. I should say, you know, that I guess the thing I left out of the presentation is I think generally that halacha should create a conversation in which people, which allows people the space to follow all the reasonable things that they believe. Like, you know, I might think that certain ideas that are prevalent in certain therapeutic circles are nonsense. But if you have a reasonable group of therapists who say it, so then you're entitled to follow it. And it's not my job halachically to say you're following the wrong therapists. All right? I think that's very important. That's very important generally. And when you're constructing a community, so right, I think that you need to, for example, allow parents to follow reasonable medical advice. Now, how you set that boundary is something that we learned is really hard during COVID. Right? Because there are outliers. Right, who take hold positions about vaccination and things like that, but who have degrees, and how you as a community, right, set your boundaries of reasonability is not in any way a simple question. But I think that the bias should be that we try and construct a community as much as possible that allows people to act in accordance with the reason, right, with their reasonable positions about the facts. And also that allows them, you know, that where it really matters to them, allows them to follow positions we consider reasonable halachically, even if we reject them. Which is why I think it's very important if you think a position is unreasonable, which I, you know, it's very rare for me to think that a position is unreasonable, but I think the position attributed to Sisley Ezra is unreasonable. So, right, so I'm making that very clear, right, that I don't, that's not a position that I think the community should make space for in terms of reliance. That's my position, but I'm, you know, that's one of the few things I'm staking myself on in this year. I think that we should not, that we need to be perfectly clear, otherwise we're going to end up in a position where we are forced to accept things that we shouldn't. Okay. Well, you also got to ask one question before, so now I'm discriminating against Maxine. Maxine, will you allow me to do it?
Yes, I will.
Okay.
Thank you. First of all, I just want to thank you for doing this series, and I think even regardless of what the conclusion is, I think that this was an incredibly valuable thing to do, and I just want to thank you for that. And now I can, you know, get to my question, which is that
everyone else should start their questions, by the way.
Do you think that it's possible that halachic gender or sex or whatever you want to call it can be determined by one's reported gender, and that the poskim who have previously said otherwise were sort of mistaken based on their sort of limited view of the gender spectrum.
What do you mean by reported?
That's what someone says their gender is.
I think for myself that that we should distinguish between biological sex and gender. And I think it's hard halakhically to claim that that biological sex is irrelevant halakhically.
You think that you think the
we should make you start with the premise again.
Do you think the equation changes if we go based on someone's appearance as opposed to their reported gender?
I'm trying to stake myself on a position that I think that a lot of halakha depends on biological sex, and then there are other things that are gender and that we should distinguish among them. That, right? That's me, right? That's where I'm staking myself. Okay. Last question, Maxine. Yes.
Yeah. No. I think just to clarify the question a little bit is when you say that there's room when we talk about gender. I think the question is how is that gender halakhically determined? Is that based on what the individual says their gender is, or is it how other people perceive them?
I think that's a great question. And I think that, what we, in the Dor HaBlechot here, we point out all the ways in which halakha hasn't addressed all sorts of questions, right? Distinctions it doesn't make between people, right? People whose appearance is obvious to other people, right? People who can, whatever the current word is, right? People who are indistinguishable from people of the other biological sex, whether people who are known to have previously been that way or not, whether they live in a community where they've been or not. What the specific issue is, right? How that ties into sexual orientation or not may also be an issue. I think that's where there's like enormous amounts of room for a serious halakhic conversation, and we haven't had it yet. Like, we're not even close to having that conversation yet. I think I've made the argument that Dor HaBlechot is not the place, not where the conversation should end, and probably not where it should start either. But beyond that. I don't know. I think that's where I have to acknowledge, among other things, that I'm not so young anymore. And so things that are obvious to me that, that you couldn't possibly do that. Somebody else might think, why can't you do that? Right. In the same way, say when I started at SBM, I was really, really uncomfortable about Koed Chavrusas. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem, I seem to have been wrong about the extent to which that raises issues, so far as I can tell. Right? That's a empirical. Maybe that society has changed. Maybe that I just was unaware of this. Right? Those are all things that can happen. And maybe I was right all along, and I'll discover it. Right? I think that's a fair issue. Yeah? Perhaps I'm somewhat biased in that. Some very good and very good endings have come out of that. In my family. right? So that's, I try very hard not to, to be aware of the limits of my own experience. And so I don't know the answer to that one yet. Okay. I think now we're past 10. So thank you, everybody. If people want to stay and ask, I'll stay as long as it is. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. There. All right. Was that a paper airplane?